Hello and welcome to ELT Under the Covers. Today we have a guest and I've been racking my brain on how to introduce him. I would say he's a modern day Renaissance man with a biography that it reads like an epic historical figure. So I'm going to have to actually read a little bit from this because it's quite extensive. He studied in psychology, hypnosis, NLP, linguistics, and education. He's the star of one of the most viewed TEDx talks on the YouTube, How to Learn a Language in 6 Months. He's the author of the book, The Third Ear, founder of Kung Fu English Language Learning System, a passionate environmentalist, polyglot entrepreneur, adventurer, educator, and just all-around legend, Chris Lonsdale. Great honor to have you on the show, sir.
Thank you, gentlemen. Great to be here.
So, amazing biography, very interesting life. How did you get here? Could you kind of give us a bit of your origin, especially with regards to language learning?
Right. How did I get here? Well, here, I guess, is time and space. So it's in Asia, and it's 2021. I actually went to China in 1981. And I got there because I was hitchhiking around New Zealand and reading a book about this guy who rode a motorbike around the world at a Triumph 500. I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. I'd like to do that. Mm. And then I thought, ah, but boring. He's already done it. And then I thought, oh, hang on a minute. He never did China as part of his loop. So I thought, I'll go do that in China. So I trundled down to the embassy in Wellington, in New Zealand, after a week or so on the road, and walked up these big stairs, these big red doors with an overhang that was just my head height, banged on the door, and this gruff sort of guy comes out, "What do you want?" And I said, "How do I go to China and ride a motorbike for a couple of years?" He says, "You can't." I said, "So how do I get to China?" He said, "There are tours." I said, "Not interested. How do I go for a few years?" He said, "Your country has scholarships, go find it." So I spent the next couple of days trundling around Wellington, walking into different government departments saying, "Do you have a scholarship for China?" And got into foreign affairs, and lo and behold, they did. Wow. And I said, I'm going to be applying for it. They said, it's coming up in 6 months. I said, "Watch out for my application, it'll be coming in." And so I did, and I'm not sure if this is my memory of my rehearsal or of actually in the interview. They brought me up to Wellington, yeah, and I hadn't done Chinese in university, and everyone else had. They'd done a couple of years, and they said, "So what makes you think that you can learn Chinese?" And I just said, "Well, I can learn to speak Scotch and speak English." So whatever, they let me on, and so I ended up on a flight and then a train to Beijing, and it sort of all went from there.
Mm. Awesome. And I mean, you know, if you're wanting to get more into Chris's background, you know, you should definitely watch his TED Talks and the numerous videos on YouTube. And so how did you kind of go about, I guess, learning Chinese?
That's the interesting thing. I decided a couple of things. I decided that I was going to use what I'd learned in psychology, especially the stuff around memory and that sort of work at the time, mm-hmm. to help. When I was at university, we had to write a paper on Piaget's stage theory of language learning, which basically said if you passed a certain age, you wouldn't be able to learn a second language. And I had seen so many people around me who had learned a second language to fluency as adults. Mm-hmm. I'd had that opportunity. And I also, as a 16-year-old, I had a chance to have someone from Tahiti stay with us for a couple of months, and I went to Tahiti for 6 weeks, mm-hmm. On an exchange sort of thing. So in that basically 12 weeks or 10 weeks, I got enough French to sail through the last two years of French in school, mm-hmm. And got second place, I think, in a national French-speaking competition. And so I went in knowing that it's possible, knowing people who had done it. And I then set myself the goal of being native level. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't speaking a little bit. It was like, I want to be native level.
So you wanted to just be just like indistinguishable from just the locals.
Exactly.
It's interesting because what I'm hearing is from your stories as well, there's no doubts in the mind. It's just, well, why can't I do this?
And exactly.
And I guess you see barriers that have put up, maybe like Piaget or, you know, more physical ones with the embassy, and it's just, well, okay, so how do I move around that? And, you know, it's a very core principle with being able to acquire skill, especially something where language, where it plays a lot into doubts and such. So how did that work out in China as you were kind of like growing as a language master, and your thoughts about starting to, I guess, teach it in a way?
Well, I lucked into a number of things. It was interesting. So there was a lot of serendipity through the journey. So, for instance, was in Beijing for maybe 10 days, and we hadn't actually started class yet. And a friend from the Middle East said, hey, why don't a bunch of us go up to Beidahu, up on the East Coast resort town? And so we trundled off and got our passes, because in those days you actually had to have a pass to go from one city to another, and they had to approve them, and you weren't allowed to ride bikes from one city to another, which we once did. But anyway, so we ended up going to Beidahu, hung out there for a couple of days, and then on the way back, we couldn't get seats on the train. It was all booked out. And the thing about Chinese trains is you could set your watch by them.
Yeah.
But there was no guarantee you would actually get a seat on one.
Yeah. I think it's still like that.
Yeah. So we ended up in the dining car, and there was a transport policeman there, and he sort of took an interest. And so he wanted to have a conversation with me, especially. And so sat down and started talking, and it was all him talking, gestures and drawing in his little notebook and showing pictures and everything else. And basically 8 hours of this overnight. Wow. And I came out of that sort of going, wow, I understood a whole lot of what he said. Mm-hmm. So that was the whole context was actually a comprehensible input context with tons of brain soaking. Mm-hmm. So I came out of that, and I back to the college where we were about to start classes, and people were saying stuff to me and I was understanding it. So I went, okay, that's really interesting. And then the next step, like, they were trying to put me into a class, and they should have put me into like a complete beginner in the language school, but they heard me speaking the language, so they put me into into this level with people who've done 2 years university Chinese, and right. Mm-hmm. And we were sitting there, like, we were having to write essays. So here was the thing. I was Wen Mang, so I was illiterate. So I could already be speaking a little bit and make my way around, and my accent was already sort of getting there.
Yeah.
But I couldn't write any characters.
Well, it's a whole different ball game, right?
Exactly. So we had to write these little stories, right? And I was looking around the room, and everyone was like, you could see them thinking in English or mother tongue, and then looking up the translations into Chinese. Mm-hmm. And I just went, what can I say? All right, I'm going to use that and write what I can say. And if I don't know how the character works, I'm going to look up the dictionary to see how to write the character. But I wasn't translating. I just decided, okay, I know this little bit of Chinese. That's what I'm going to write with. And that's how I did it. And so that was also an insight, that you work with the core. You start with what you've got. You use it. And then you extend out from that core as you go, rather than trying to translate from one language to another.
Yeah. I mean, this is all in your books, with the five principles and seven actions. And I do want to touch on more of that, but I'm interested with So I mean, you're getting immersed in Chinese. You're really getting a grasp of the language at this point. When does it sort of transition to going to a realization of going, actually, this maybe a lot of language learners aren't doing it this way, and this was really working really well for me. How can I guess, teach this, and how do I go about like putting together this system, this book, and such?
All right. Well, that was a long, long gap between the two.
Oh yeah. So I mean,
Yeah.
yeah,
So
if that is that, I mean, there's probably
it was a.
points that you want to fill in, but I'm just a
It,
neither
yeah.
neither,
It was.
so.
No. It was a long, long gap. I never had any intention of teaching English or language or anything else. I did some English teaching for a group of cadres in a science university and stuff, and they were all very eager and very nice, but it was sort of like traditional pedagogy, and they all struggled. All right, so that really wasn't what interested me. I was training in the martial arts, and I got myself into the Beijing Institute of Physical Education to train in Chinese martial arts full time, and managed to wreck my knees in the process. So I then ended up in Sichuan province, and I was training with the Sichuan provincial martial arts team and getting my knees treated by a Chinese herbalist, and living in a basically a 50 cents a day US room in a hotel. So there's a hotel, basically foreigners could only stay in the 5-star hotels, and I couldn't pay for it. And I offered to wash dishes and stuff, and they said no, but they gave me this like 50 cents a day thing. But the deal was there were three beds in there, so any travelers coming through got to use the other two beds. So I
Oh,
had this so I had
it's
this
looking
this
you were
this
like adventure.
It was an endless stream of these people coming through, and I had this book called Shaolin Si Min Jian Gu Shi, which is Legends of the Shaolin Monastery. It was in Chinese, so I sat down to translate it. So my time in Sichuan was spent training and getting my knees looked at and translating this book. And pretty much by the end of that, I was coming up to the end of the scholarship period, which I managed to actually get extended for a third year. Which almost never happens. Somebody had dropped out, and there was this overhang. And so, since I wanted to stay, they let me stay. So they basically supported me for a third year. But then that time was running out, and I went back to Beijing. And I tried to get jobs with multinationals in Beijing, and no one would hire me. And I'm sure it's because I spoke Chinese too well. And to give you an example, I was with the coach for the martial arts team in Sichuan, and it was coming up the Chinese New Year, and he wanted a bottle of Wuliang Ye, which you've heard of Maotai, I guess, right? The spirit water, right? So Wuliang Ye is the Sichuan version, and it's actually smoother, it's better.
It's spicy.
Knock your head off. So he wanted to buy a bottle for his teacher, and he couldn't find any anywhere in the city. I said, "Well, look, I'll get you some from the hotel." And he completely straight-faced, not joking at all, he said to me, "They won't let you in." Because in those days, if you were a Chinese person wearing normal Chinese street clothes, these 5-star hotels and everything else were you couldn't get in as a local. Cadres could get in, foreigners could get in, but a person who was just a local Chinese person couldn't get in. So this guy was just saying to me, completely straight faced, believing what he says, they won't let you in. So I had at that point hit the goal of basically being perceived as local.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And mixed with your no doubts, then it was a dangerous combination for the Chinese.
Well, I don't know about that. I actually think they can be pretty creative. They're hard driving. I learned something really important about the Chinese versus the Americans. Basically, in my first couple of weeks in Beijing, there was this tug of war competition that was arranged, and it was the Americans and the foreigners in one team. All these big chunky guys, and you got these little short Chinese guys on the other side, right? And the Western team sort of was walking off and coming back and not talking about how to do this, no preparation. The Chinese team was just talking and practicing and getting themselves ready. Mm-hmm. And so you've got, you know, like twice the weight on the Western side. Mm-hmm. And these Chinese guys just creamed it. They just took the Westerners
across
the line.
I totally believe
that.
I remember this one time we were moving apartment, and here I am with some of my American, big burly American friends, and we're trying to move a fridge upstairs because obviously no elevator, right? And we're having a heck of a time because it's super hot in Shenzhen, so it's slipping, sliding everywhere. And up to like the third floor, and this Chinese guy opens his door and he's like, "What's going on? What's with all the banging?" And sees us kind of like we're struggling. We're like, "Oh, don't worry, don't worry." He's like, "Oh, I'm gonna help." I'm like, "Oh, what's he gonna do?" And then he comes and he just gets like a whole bunch of ropes, whips it around the fridge, puts it on his back, and he's up and he's gone. And we're like, I don't know, just there, just stood holding ourselves completely limp. And I don't want to get too much into kind of China and any sort of politics around that, but I love China, and it's very misunderstood, especially the people level, and it's a fantastic place to just be and to have adventures. You will have adventures whether you want it or not.
Exactly. So back, go ahead.
I was just thinking, Chris, before we, because we're kind of progressing towards, because Neil kind of put it onto track to how you got into teaching. But I was thinking a bit more just about your sort of journey as a language learner there, and obviously it's massive to to go from no Chinese to speaking, an indistinguishable or even almost indistinguishable level to a native speaker. And you know, you've hinted at some of kind of the general ideas of the way that you did it. As you say, really, I mean, one aspect of it is the communication aspect. Obviously, you're a good communicator, and your experience with the guy on the train kind of showed you, you know, being a good communicator, and him also wanting to engage, and you know, that principle of comprehensible input allows you to kind of make a good deal of progress, which is, you know, sort of one of the linchpins of communicative language teaching, isn't it? That sort of idea. And I'm just wondering about the kind of the nitty gritty bits, the bits of like how you would refine your accent, because I feel like, I mean, from your story, it sounds like you're someone who was able to pick up the pronunciation pretty well, you know. And I'm just wondering if you have anything to say about that, like, because that's one of the things that people really struggle with all language learning, but especially something like Chinese for a Westerner, the pronunciation is a lot of people consider it as a roadblock, you know.
It's a different song,
right? Okay, then let me tell you a story. A few years ago, somebody came to me in my office in Hong Kong. He's a French guy. And he spoke English, but he had quite a heavy accent, and he wanted me to help him change his accent to sound English. Mm-hmm. So I said, sure, we can do that. And we basically started, and we were 10, 15 minutes in, and I was just guiding him on how he needed to do it. And he was really sounding English. Mm-hmm. And then he went, I don't want to have to feel like this. I've decided to stay with my French accent. Mm-hmm. So accent comes from a mixture of all of the muscles in your face and your throat and everything else and how you use them. Mm. It's completely tied up with your expressions, right? So like if you start speaking Scots, you begin to talk like an Indian man, and then you're already nodding the head and the way the face feels and looks is different, right? So there's your identity, the physical identity that you have is tied up with your accent.
Yeah, I can I can totally see that. I mean, from I think we've talked about this before, right, Rich? You know, when we've when because we both went to started our journey in Spain together, and we both kind of we I remember we had this conversation where we're like, I do feel like a different person when you're speaking in Chinese, because you know my voice would get a bit deeper, and
In Spanish. Yeah,
and
we I mean we chatted about it from more of a just a mental perspective. I don't think I've actually considered before like specifically what Chris is saying right now about the physical aspect actually, because obviously the you know the it the mouth is one of the primary speech organs, and it is tied to your facial expression. And I've never thought about that actually affecting how you kind of behave and feel before, but I think it seems actually now it's like the elusive obvious. It's something that's, yeah, of course, yeah. If you, because if I just force a smile, I start to feel a bit more energetic, and if I kind of do this, then I start to feel a different way, right? And of course, if you're making different sounds and it's changing your mouth, it's gonna do that. It's really an interesting aspect of
We
what.
could turn this into a whole podcast, I feel, just based around this, because it's a very interesting idea. And I know, Chris, that you have alongside Kung Fu English, you have this I don't know what the course name, rhythmic, 'cause I see like rhythmic Cantonese, rhythmic. So I would presume that there's aspects of this within that, so where you kind of, I guess this one's more based on the sounds, but do you kind of cover like how to kind of position your face to make?
We do in Kung Fu English, and we actually have face models.
Oh, really?
So because when I was learning Mandarin, it was like my face used to hurt.
Yeah, totally.
I God, it's like if I've done a 2-hour marathon or something.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's. I mean, there's a brain burn as well when you're trying to just mentally go through that process, especially because you're learning something new all the time, right? But I want to get more into this, but I feel like we're not quite there yet. So.
Right. One of the things I would do, right? The other angle of this is listening. The more you listen, the more you're getting the accent without even thinking about it. So I used to spend hours with a couple of friends. So like one guy would take me up to his room. We'd go to blackboard and we'd talk until 1, 2 a.m. and he'd be doing most of the talking. So I'd be listening to that. But his friend, who was an artist, would go for gels and a beer, and he was like really heavy Beijing, and so I would be mimicking him, listening to him talking a lot, and then I would find myself just during the day picking certain words that were a little bit, I wasn't quite there yet, and just doing them, 20 seconds, 30 seconds here, another minute there. Like the toughest sound, I think, for Westerners, well, especially English speakers, to get is xue. Xue xi, right? It's just we don't use our face that way, and that took a while. I would say there's 60 to 70% of the sounds in Mandarin are completely overlap with English,
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
right? But there's
Yeah.
things that are not, and that are
So,
like way out there.
because when you were sort of listening to people. And the reason why I asked this or mentioned this is because it's something I've heard from like polyglots before. Did you kind of pay particular attention to people's like mouth and this sort of area of their face? This is something that I've heard from polyglots before, that they kind of watch people. It's not just listening, but they actually watch people a lot when they speak, and then that kind of helps them to get an idea of how those sounds are made.
Yeah, but it's not done. It's like it's not done consciously.
Right, okay.
What is interesting is you're watching, but you're not trying to sort of logically interpret what's going on. And if you look at a little kid, when the mother is speaking, the kid will do exactly the same thing. They look at the mother's face between nose and chin, and they're just intently focused on the face, which is why masking kids and people is completely nuts.
They're gonna
grow up with their language abilities severely hampered.
There's gonna be a lot of unintended consequences.
Oh yeah.
I mean,
I didn't even think about kids, but kids, it's going to be terrible for them in terms of language skills. But I mean, I was talking to actually a student of mine who's an English teacher in Spain, and she the other day, and she was telling me how they're still wearing masks in the language classroom, you know, and I'm just like, yeah, but it's a language classroom. like, you really need to see some, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. So, it's lots and lots and lots of listening, playing with it. One of the things that I did was to stretch the mouth, so play with sounds. Ooh. Like little babies babble and they sort of lie down and they sort of test the boundaries. So you need to stretch your face to the extremes and sort of soften it up so it can go into those new positions.
Like stretching, exactly,
and breaking the old patterns as well. But as soon as you've done that, it actually becomes relatively simple, and then it's like you really need to look for the sounds that map what you already have. So in Chinese, wa. Right, and you think about it in English, you'll have sounds in English like ah, right? So we don't have the W before it, but you have that ah sound, and you just realize, okay, well, we have the ah sound in English, so I just put the w in front of it, and I have wa, and done. So you knock off a whole bunch of stuff that's actually easy for you, as long as you are prepared to soften the boundaries in your head about what words are.
Do you know what comes to mind? I don't know if you're familiar with Michelle Thomas. It reminds me of this because, you know, we're huge fans of Michelle Thomas on the podcast, and one of his principles is, I can't remember what Rich might have to help me with this, what he calls it, but basically he says, he focuses on, well, what do we have in your native language that we can cross over into this new language to make it easier? Mm. He focused more on lexi, so, you know, like...
Yeah, it's a
little bit more difficult with Mandarin because, you know, like we say mango, Mandarin's like mangua or what have you. Well, so there's a few Len words here or there. But, he was focusing more on Romance languages, and that makes it a lot easier. So what I'm hearing with you is kind of the same sort of principle, but with
the same phonemics,
the same sounds.
Well, the phonemics, but also the logic of the language.
Yes.
Right. So the logic in Mandarin is very similar to the logic of English, again, with a 20-30% difference. But the 70% in terms of word order and everything else, it is exactly the same.
Right. So, in terms, it might be easier than learning some, like Spanish or something that's a little bit more
exactly.
Back to front.
Right, so it's easier for a Western to learn Mandarin than it is for a Cantonese speaker.
Right,
because a Cantonese speaker gets trapped halfway.
Yeah,
they sort of hear the sound in Cantonese, they hear it in Mandarin, and they morph it a little bit, but they never go 100%. And because they're also trying to learn from the text, not just hearing it and using it, they've always got their automatic subconscious things happening, their processes happening in their brain, so they see the character in that using a Cantonese accent for it. Right. So there are lots of interesting complexities in this, right?
That is really interesting. It reminds me actually of how people who come from very phonemic languages, as in where there's a very close relationship between the sounds and the way the words are spelled, they really struggle to get the pronunciation in other languages where there's more phonemic sounds, because they're always kind of, as you say, like they're like automatically linking letters to sounds, and they find it so difficult to not do that. even when it's exactly. really clear that that letter in this language is not that sound. You know, that, they still and do.
I got to a point where I literally have to tell people letters don't make sounds.
Mm. I think there would be a lot of people that would even not, well, maybe not consciously have that, but then as soon as you say that, go, oh, shit, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Letters don't make sounds, okay? Letters and letter combinations represent sounds that you can already hear and that you can already make.
It's like the whole nugget of, you know, words don't have meanings, you know, apart from what we subscribe to them.
And exactly.
Yeah, do you have any people just turning into puddles of who am I, Chris? What's going on?
Yeah, a little bit sometimes. Yeah. A little bit sometimes. Monolinguals have that problem.
Yeah.
People who've grown up bilingual or multilingual, like places like Malaysia, don't, because they already get that words are labels, and you can change the labels as you like, basically. So yeah. But monolinguals really struggle with it, because for them the sound is the thing and the letters make sounds. And it's like, ah.
Yep.
No.
Yep. Okay. So where were we at?
We started talking about how did I sort of get to deciding to sort of teach this stuff. I got sick and tired of the conversations about, oh, you speak Chinese really well, you must be talented. I'm not.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh God, not another one. Mm. It became really, really, really irritating. It's like, no, you can do it too. Oh no, I can't. I'm not a language learner. You know, I'm tone deaf. And it's like, really? Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah, okay. Well, you're hearing those tones. They're not tone deaf. I've never learned a language before. Yes, you have. What are you speaking now? No one taught you. You learned it by yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I got really tired of those conversations, and they would happen a lot. So I said, got to write a book. And just at the time where I decided to go for it and write the book, SARS hit.
Oh.
So I was running my consulting business, and I was on a plane every week to different cities in Asia, and all that stopped. So I sat down and wrote the third ear, you can learn any language, and codified the process basically of going in country and what do you do, mm-hmm. and the steps you need to take and what you need to understand about your internal mental processes and managing your own emotions and all that.
Mm.
And then that book, after it came out, a whole bunch of people. So I never set out to teach language, but I just had to put a stake in the ground on this point, because I was so tired of the belief systems that were limiting people.
Well, you know, it's almost like they're trying to put those beliefs on you, right? It's like when it's so widespread, it becomes like a society thing where it's like, well. It's almost, you know, you could apply it to caste systems or stuff like that. You grew up working class, you're going to stay working class, and that's it. And, you know, that's how society works. And so it's kind of almost a pushback against, you know, authority and these ingrained ideas, which, you know, aren't obviously true, but, you know. You're a bit of a Galileo, right. A Galileo in regards to language.
Yeah. So anyway, I wrote the book, and then a whole bunch of people started using it. Mm-hmm. And we had several guys from different countries took the book, read it, went to China, and they were speaking fluently in 6 months. Mm-hmm. And a girl from India went to Chile, and she was speaking Spanish in 6 months, to the point where she was hired as head of sales for a big IT company. Another girl from Australia who'd failed at Dutch in Holland, because the attitude there was, don't bother, you'll never learn our language. So she read the book, she went to Brazil, and she was basically bilingual within about 6 months. She got a job head of diversity in a big multinational. So all these stories were coming in from people who read the book and went and applied the ideas. That was where the TEDx title came from, how to learn any language in 6 months, because there were so many people who had done it by following these principles. So, so I just decided to go with that as the title of the TEDx talk.
So you wrote this book, and I mean, let's get into the book a little bit, and it lends with the TEDx talk. I mean, I didn't read, I've not read the book. I've read snippets, and you know, I've listened to the TED talk, and you know, I like it. I find it more of a holistic approach, and I could see how people would find it frustrating because it's not giving them, no, now you need to learn this grammar point or do this or this. It's more kind of a broader, this is the mindset that you need, and this is how you should approach it. And if you kind of follow all these principles, then, you know, it's going to work out. I see a mirror between this and like the fitness world, where they have all these different diets and approaches to how to lose weight, when really you just say to someone, exercise and watch your calorie intake, you know, make it a little bit less than what you need to maintain, and you're going to lose weight. It doesn't have to be more complex than that. I kind of see that with your book. There's some of the points that I saw with the five principles. You've got that comprehensive. I'll just, if you don't mind, I'll read them out that I have short because I want to make sure that Rich is fresh. So we've got one, focus on language that's relevant to you, which is kind of like that Michelle Thomas thing that I mentioned. Two, use language to communicate. Three, comprehensible input. Four, language, not knowledge. So kind of like physiological training. And then five, physiological state matters. So to be relaxed. So the last part reminded me a lot of Suggestopedia.
Yeah.
So, I read that you were initially interested in hypnosis and stuff. So, yeah, I completely agree with that. And that's a big thing for Michelle Thomas as well, is to make it sure it's a relaxed atmosphere. But I wondered, so it seems like there's a lot of kind of psychological principles in there.
Yeah, do you care to expand on that? That's sort of Suggestopedia thing. The idea of learning being a lot more effective when you're relaxed. And in fact, Suggestopedia, 1960s language learning method, it was very prescriptive about the environment and things. It was like, you know, you play classical music, you have sofas, you have plants, and the whole thing takes place in this very relaxed environment. I think there was a lot of psychological interest in that idea at the time, and this idea that learning takes place much more effectively when people are relaxed. And it's kind of like it's all been thrown out the window now. Like, you don't really hear people talk about that anymore, you know, you need to be relaxed to learn effectively. It's kind of all disappeared, and I don't know why. I don't think it's been debunked or anything.
It's like really great software is disappeared because they keep upping the OSs, and the people who make the really great software can't keep up with the changes needed to stay with the OS. It's really sad.
But, yeah, that's a good analogy.
I read Georgi Lozanov's book three times or four times, and I put together Suggestopedia based learning for Westerners to learn Mandarin. So I did one in Hong Kong for a couple of weeks, and I did another one in Beijing for a couple of weeks, and it's an enormous amount of work to do it really well. But all from Lozanov's work was, it's not so much that you've got a really relaxed environment and all of that. The core was the music. So, but not just that, it was the lexical mapping of the language. So you have mother tongue, target, space, all done in time with the music. The mother tongue chunk would be a meaning chunk, and it would be mapped with an equal meaning chunk in the target language.
Okay.
So that was part of it, okay? And the Baroque was about putting you into an alpha state, breaking it up with lots of games and exercises, having posters around the room, colorful posters where the language was represented in those posters. But the absolute core, was when he said he doesn't do hypnosis, and he hated hypnosis because it was used as a tool of manipulation in Bulgaria. That's why he called it Suggestopedia. That was one piece of it. But the other piece was that he would never correct anybody.
Interesting.
Do not correct. Do not correct. And so what he would be doing was noticing what people were trying to communicate. He would then be feeding back to them, this is what you mean, right? And so he wouldn't correct anything. He would simply model the correct way of doing it as soon as possible after the event, and people's brains would pick it up. And I took that and I actually extended that. So I was doing a lot of training work for corporates at that time. And I was in a sales workshop in Wuxi, in Jiangsu. And... I deliberately did that. So people would say stuff that was not right and I wouldn't correct them. I would just take it and then model the right way of doing it about, you know, within the next 2 minutes or so. And that was by far and away the best training I had ever done in my whole life. Just applying that principle. And it was non-language. So I just built that into my repertoire of what I was doing from then on, and it's just made a massive difference. So adults especially, but even kids, can't take being made wrong and being corrected all the time. But they're always open to feedback, which comes from the interaction and the communication.
I mean, that kind of brings me to the next stages of the book. The seven actions. So the seven actions were the listen, the patterns and rhythm, 2, meaning before words, 3, start mixing what you know to be and basically be creative, 4, focus on core common words, 5, language parent, 6, copy the face, and 7, direct connect to the language. To kind of connect words to responsibilities. What I think you've just previously talked about, it links very much with that language parent, because it's almost like you are parenting. It is like you are parenting. It's quite literally.
Exactly.
And I, you know, I've got a young 2-year-old right now, and I've read this before, and this is exactly, I mean, I've got a background in language teaching, so this is exactly what I do with him. I don't, you know, get him to say this word, say that word, you know, I just, you know, what we're playing with, I talk about it, and, you know, I use, you know, the label for that, or if he says something and it's a bit wrong, you know, like he says window rather than window, you know, I just repeat what he says back to him, but with the correct pronunciation. It doesn't really matter if he gets it right that time, but that exposure builds,
exactly.
Right?
And there's almost a there's almost a probabilistic function going on. Mm-hmm. So you'll find that if you correct someone, or if you model, which is the best way to do it, they won't necessarily change straight away. Mm-hmm. And then they might start getting it right 10% of the time. Mm-hmm. And then they move to 20%. Then they move to 30%. Then they move to 40%. And then they get to 50-50. And from there, they might quickly go to 100%, or they still step it up. So Their brain has to be ready to hear the difference, to understand the difference. Then they have to start using it when they think of it. And so you get this probabilistic function happening over time. It's higher and higher probability that it's going to be the correct form, but it's not 100% for quite some time.
Do you think it's worth considering encouraging language learners to reflect about things like that, or would you just completely step back and kind of just let things happen in that way?
They're adults, so you have to teach them to get out of their own way. They're into, I have to remember this many words and I have grammar, and no, you don't. You actually don't have to learn the grammar. In fact, learning grammar is probably the worst thing you can do. You will get the grammar as you use the language. You will intuit, okay, the words go in this order. You will intuit the ing means it's ongoing. You will intuit the ed means that it's finished, right? So it's not that you're not learning the grammar, it's that you're not consciously left brain trying to analyze it as a way of mastering it. So I'm not saying that grammar is not important. Grammar is a layer of meaning that is not in the lexicon itself.
Yeah, I kind of often see it as almost like code. It's kind of, you only really need to learn about it if you need to, I don't know, I guess, fix certain parts, or you don't know, well, why am I going wrong with this particular writing part? And then you have to consciously sort of figure it out, I guess, as a native speaker. But it's very interesting, and this idea of exposure, I think, is really important, because it lends well with that kind of suggestopedia aspect of it, that it helps you relax into it. And I actually use this principle not just with language, like with my son. This is our approach to getting him to try new foods. He has a whole bunch of safe foods, and then we'll try and introduce a new food, and we don't force him to eat the new food. We'll eat the new food, and it'll just be there on the plate, and it might be there on the plate for 3 or 4 times before he even touches it. And then one time he's going to touch it, and he's going to play with it and hold it, and then maybe 10, 15 times that down the way, he actually tries it and puts it in his mouth, and he's like, eh, and then he might spit it out. But that's not the point. It's just being exposed and it being there. Yeah, it seems to be a core principle of learning, not just in language, but just kind of...
Anything.
Yeah.
Yep. It's absolutely a core of learning anything.
Yeah.
Right. You start with what you can do, and then you slowly test the edges. You look at little animals, right? Mm-hmm. They will be with the mom, and then they'll go out 10 meters and come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the next day they'll do 11 meters.
Yep.
And come back. Right. And then the next day they'll do 12 meters, and they come rushing back.
Yeah. Oh my God. What did I do?
Pretty much. And a year later, the cat buggers off and you don't see him for 2 days.
Yeah. Oh, you're still around? Yeah, he's kind of... And then it's then the parents lost their role, I guess. But I guess it's a transitory thing anyway.
A transitory thing. Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, though. So you were going through the actions. Listening a lot is absolutely key. Mm-hmm. You talked.
Yeah, mm-hmm, go on.
No, you talked about focusing on getting the meaning first. You talked about comprehensible input, and most people don't understand what that is. Mm-hmm. It actually means that when you get the meaning, you will subconsciously acquire the words and the linguistic structures.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's literally taught in the CELTAs, MFP, right? Meaning, form, pronunciation. You know, building up from that. But I think what you're getting at is it really should be a big part of the circle rather than a small part.
It almost sounds like Chris is saying that you know, you just the only thing they need to kind of consciously learn, students or language learners need to consciously learn, is the meaning, and the other things will sort of fall into place.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much. But you know, I can be there with you like this, and I can go Trifana.
Right.
And you get it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you got the meaning, you'd never heard the words before.
Mm.
And that happens in your story, you know, touching the stuff on the plate and coming back, it's there, and then touch it again. So you've got these two processes operating simultaneously. Mm-hmm. You're going to pick it up. So the next time you hear trifan, you'll know what it means. The third time you hear trifan, like they're standing by the table, they're telling you to come over, trifan. So you've already worked out, okay, it's let's eat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? And so you're not even translating it. You're connecting all of this information, which is the meaning, to those sounds that you're hearing in the sequence that they're used. And your brain is literally noticing those patterns and storing those patterns. Mm-hmm. Right?
So leading with teaching, I don't know how you would phrase that, concepts. Is it Piaget that does the schemas where with the little kids where the focus is on making sure teaching, I guess, concepts like transportation. So, oh, this car moves. What else moves? This ball moves. Taking these big, broader concepts, but I guess with language, it's kind of like, what? Oh, this is eat, but you know, can we use this in different other ways and stuff? Is that kind of? I think I've just lost my thought.
No, well,
sorry, it's like 4 a.m. here.
Okay, sorry about that. It was James Asher. Mm-hmm. It was James Asher who came up with the idea of a total physical response. Mm-hmm. So again, there's probably lots of people who've done this in slightly different ways. Mm-hmm. But it's always connecting to the physical world. It's always connecting to how objects relate to other objects. It's going to be talking about feelings, states, positions, right? There's a core of meaning around our physical presence in the world and the objects that we interact with. Mm-hmm. And we need, so that sort of brings us to that direct connect to mental images. It's actually internal representations. So you need to be connecting the sounds to the internal representations that you have of the world. So your representation of cup may be different to my representation of cup, but they're close enough in overlap because they both link to real world cups.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, if I hear cup and I get this image of a cup, then I'm speaking the language for cup.
Yeah.
Right. So, and you can then design a course around that idea so that people are, first of all, labeling the concrete objects. Then you expand to classes of objects. And what kids tend to do, they will use one concrete object to talk about the class.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, you know, vessel. A drinking vessel, right? Mm-hmm. So you've got glasses, cups, bowls, all that sort of stuff, right? So that's a memory that we're building up, if that makes sense. But yet you've got to start going really concrete, not abstract.
Yeah. So it's induction, as they say.
Rather than
deduction.
It's induction. Yeah. You have to induct your way into a language. You cannot deduct your way into a language. You try deducting your way into a language without the basis, and I go down so many rabbit holes and never come out.
So is that, I mean, let's talk a little bit about Kung Fu English. So is that kind of the principle that you use with that? It starts out with these concrete examples, and you build from that, and you mix in the rhythmic and music and patterns and stuff, or yeah, well, I mean, what's the approach? Because I mean, it's a Chinese app, so I don't have an iPhone, so I wasn't able to kind of play with it. So I'm just interested of like this language system that you've developed. What's the approach with that?
Everything that we've talked about has been built into the product.
Okay.
I mean, literally everything. So you start and you will be listening to something, and all you need to do is make a note of how much of it, if any, you understood.
Okay.
And it could be nothing, right? You then ask to brain soak. So give you something, you listen to it for 5 minutes, and you're listening not with the intent of understanding anything. You're listening with the intent of noticing things that repeat, noticing the rhythms, noticing the pitch. Now, all of that is designed to put your attention on the nonverbal aspects of the language signal. And also to train your ear, because if you're not hearing the language, you don't open the filters in your brain, so you can't hear it. And I found this out myself one day. We made the Spanish product, and I was listening to it, and I was really getting irritated with the tech team, with the sound team. And oh, the sound is terrible. You can't hear anything really clearly. It's just awful, right? And I was listening to it, and then it got clearer and clearer, and I realized that it was not the sound, that was my brain.
Because you're trying too hard to kind of listen to it, and it's like shutting you down, I guess.
No, it's literally your brain needs to hear it enough for it to go, okay, so this is actually a signal I should be paying attention to, rather than a signal that I'm going to filter out.
I totally agree with that. See, I've played guitar for 20 years, and one of my favorite analogies for language learning is between learning the language and learning the musical instrument, because not only is the kind of psychological process similar, but there's a lot of things that are analogous, like training your ear and training your muscle memory.
Yes.
And I 100% agree that, you know, those are kind of key parts of learning a language.
Yep. Exactly.
Like initially, I remember when I was a teenager. So I started learning guitar at 18, but I remember when I used to, because I was really into music in my teens, way more than I am now. And I used to listen to all kinds of stuff when I was 14, 15, 16, but I didn't really hear the instruments. I just kind of listened to the song, right? And then when I started playing guitar, I really started to hear the guitar, you know. And these days, if I listen to something and there's a guitar in it, not only do I hear a guitar, but I kind of know how they're playing it. You know, I know more or less where their hand is. I know kind of what they're doing, right?
Exactly. Mm. It's the same with language. You know exactly what someone is going to, and you heard say next before it even came out. Because we have these patterns in mind, and our brain is actually running ahead and filling it in. When you get to a certain age, you find that you actually know what's coming in the language, because that's the highest probability thing that's going to come in that sequence.
That's it.
Yeah. So it also lends to kind of maybe why something like comedy works, because it's you listen to a stand-up comedian, and then you're listening to the story, and then it's an interrupt because it's not what you expect, and then you get the reaction of, especially if it's something that's unexpected but kind of a bit strange, it's funny. And it catches you off guard.
It's almost always two storylines.
Yeah.
New storyline. So you're filling all the way back that second narrative.
Yeah.
Right. So telling one narrative, and then right at the end, the punchline actually gives you, oh, it's a different narrative. Right. Mm-hmm. And as a simple example is like Billy Connolly's one, like the two Glasgow lads on the way home from work one day. Yeah. One says the other, Jesus Christ, I'll get home tonight, gotta rip the West knickers off. What for, says the other one? Oh, the elastic's hurting my legs.
That is fantastic scotch. Yeah.
I spent 2 hours in Beijing trying to convince a bunch of guys from Scotland that I'd never been to Scotland in my life, and they wouldn't believe
me. Brilliant.
Well, it was like, look, I've never been there, really. I'm telling the truth. No, you're not, because you've been there. Grew up there, Ned, dude.
That's fantastic. That's brilliant, yeah.
I really like this approach, and, you know, from everything that you've spoke, I think this is one of the ways that we should be moving forward with language learning. It's just one of the pushbacks with that, I feel, is that it doesn't seem to match with, I guess, society expectations or instant gratification. And I think that's why this sort of stuff gets kind of pushed to the side, because, you know, people like, I want to learn a language, give me 10 phrases. YouTube video, top 10 phrases that you need to know in Chinese to get you out on the street. Whereas, not, you know, no one wants to sit round and just, you know, listen and, you know, brain soak. So it's annoying, because it's obviously the way to do it.
I hear you, but we don't just brain soak. So, like, lesson one, right, you're going to be getting, how do I say this in English? Mm-hmm. So we do it as a rhythmic song. It's how, it's a ma, how. Mm-hmm. Sure, mm-hmm. Say ying yu, right? So we're using the music, we're using the lexical mapping, and you're learning how to say, how do I say this in English? And then you're probably wondering, why am I learning this? It's because you need to be using the language to learn the language. It has to be your go-to methodology to get new information. Because mm-hmm. you'll see people learning a new language and then they jump to mother tongue and they say, how do you say that? No. You're in the target and you use the target to ask about, and you can drop in the word or you can hold up the object, mm-hmm. right? Mm. But you insist to yourself that you use the language to inquire about the language, right? And then very quickly you get into I want water, I want some food, right? So you got to be very practical, very fast, right? Mm. Got to be very practical, very fast. Mm-hmm. But so the way we designed it in Kung Fu English was to loop it. So you do some brain soaking, you would listen to the music, you get the lexical chunking, you do a little bit of what we call L2B. So you will hear, you know, the door, and you see a picture of a door, and you'll see a picture of a man walking, and you hear the sound walk, mm-hmm. right? And then you get walk to the door, and you get to a point where you've got eight pictures and you hear a phrase, and you have to select the picture which is the correct one, which matches the phrase. And we actually encourage people not just to listen and choose the pictures, but to physically do it. So, you know, put the orange into the bowl. So you've got an orange in a bowl and man dropping it in. That's the picture. But in your house, you can do it on your table. You can get the various things, the objects, and you're mm-hmm. hearing it and you're responding to it physically with the body. Mm-hmm. All right. So, and everything we do is micro lessons. So the pronunciation might be 30 seconds with the video of 10 words and you're looking at the face. And then you've got some music, and then you might do a little bit of L2B where you're playing around with the pictures. And then you will do a little test where you're hearing words and you have to pick the picture, or you hear you see a picture and you hear the words in sequence and you have to pick which word matches the picture. So all the way through, we're getting people to connect their internal representations from multiple directions to the lexicon, and their brain soaking and their hearing is improving. And then we give them live coaches, so they will have maybe half a dozen contexts that they could talk about, you know, getting a hotel room or whatever, and then they do a live one-on-one. So 80% of the time they're self-learning, and 20% of the time they're pulling it out with interactions with their language parent.
Ah, that's fascinating. It's very different to the language learning apps or systems that I've sort of experienced, and I know other people deal with, because it seems like there's a lot more integration. Like, you've the Michelle Thomas course, Pilsner and all that jazz, they're all audio. And then you've got like Duolingo and you know, well, a whole bunch of different ones that I won't go into naming, where they focus on, you know, like the writing. They do have pronunciation and videos and stuff, but it seems like you've got a whole different approach that's a little bit more, I don't know, holistic, and especially integrating a language pair in as well. I didn't realize that you actually did that. So is that kind of like part of the whole membership that you're going, move towards that?
Yep. So very quickly, we have coaches. So if they get stuck, they can have conversations around how they're thinking about it. We have videos which talk about all these principles, demonstrate them in action. And then when they're at a certain point, they've got milestones. So when they hit a certain milestone, they need to present a video with themselves talking about something that they upload to their account, and then they'll get feedback from the coaches on that. And then they get to have their one-on-one with their language parent. And for some of them, they maybe never were able to learn English before, and like they come out there first, oh, they had a conversation with a foreigner.
No, that's fantastic. One of the best ways that I've heard so far of integrating technology with language learning, because a lot of it's just by the app, and you click this, click that, and you can get, you know, maybe to A1, A2 with just using an app or something like that, but then you always need that live component.
Yes.
So I think having that and integrated that is the first time that I've heard of doing that. So that's.
I'm really fascinated by several elements of the method, of your method, Chris. I mean, I didn't do any kind of research on your backstory or anything. Neil did all that. So I was coming into this interview with no sort of idea of your background or the things you've done. I haven't.
That's just how we do
it. TED Talk either, But yeah, some of these things I find really fascinating, like how you mentioned focusing on micro expressions. Like, it's never occurred to me to kind of guide students towards focusing on micro expressions, but I find the concept fascinating because, you know, it's obviously, you know, it's all about communication, and just anything that can draw people's attention and interest to something that's going to aid that communication in itself is interesting to me, but also the effect that it can have on their learning, I find that really interesting as well. What you said before about accent being tied into facial expressions and how people feel, and this idea of when you were kind of coaching this French guy or whatever, and then he basically discovered that he didn't want an English accent because he didn't like the personality that it gave him.
Right? Exactly.
Which I think is a massive issue, actually, you know, because, you know,
it is.
Maybe if you want to be the kind of polite, but sort of almost a little bit, you know, a little bit kind of the old empire style of speaking, then maybe British is the way to go. And it's all,
but
you know,
isn't
hello
that
and good day
their concept, that. Though? That's what I find interesting. Isn't that his concept of what an English person is? Because, you know, obviously I'm not that kind of old mindset of the imperialist, I don't know, kind of Churchill kind of guy or something. I don't see British people like that.
Yeah, but you're speaking sort of Northern English, like Yorkshire, you know, so you've got that, you know, salt of the earth. You know, I'm Neil from Yorkshire, and I grew up. You know, you've got that sort of thing going on, right? So it's different.
But that's what I mean. You know, like the French guy, he didn't want to be whatever he imagined a British person to be, or is it just kind of if you have the British accent, there's a certain personality that gets attributed to, regardless of, you know, what you think of as British people. Like, do languages have their own personalities that if you learn them and you learn them natively, do they come on to you? I mean, Chris, what do you think of something like that?
They do. They do. When I'm speaking Cantonese, I feel completely different to when I'm speaking Mandarin.
Interesting.
Completely different again when I'm speaking English. Yeah, and like, you know, the Japanese, if there's something weird happens, like like you won't see that anywhere else in the world, but they
do that, right?
Exactly. I mean, every, you know, the French, you know, puffing the cheeks and you've got these stereotypical motions and expressions that different languages use, and you just need to see that and you know which language it is.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Do you think there are any advantages or disadvantages to having, you know, certain languages? Do you know, like, would you, like, for example, Chris, you know, you're an adventurer, just a legend, but, you know, do you go, okay, I've got to walk across, you know, the North Pole. What language am I going to be thinking to get through this? Or if you're going to go, oh, I'm going to go on a date with this girl, what language should I be kind of like trying to adopt in my head of how I'm going to, you know, interact?
Yeah, but if I'm going to walk across Antarctica, I'm going to basically learn penguin. and if I'm going to date this girl, I'm going to be learning body language.
Good point.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, there's that idea around that you change your physiology, you know, maybe that would, you would be more attractive if you were acting or carrying yourself in different ways.
Is your language learning program, it's currently just aimed at teaching Chinese. English to Chinese speakers?
Yeah, it's Mandarin. It's for Mandarin speakers to learn English, and the reason for that was the industry as a whole takes billions and delivers nothing.
Do you have plans to expand into other languages?
Yeah. We're beginning to look at getting licensees for other markets, and then localizing. So, because the way the content is designed, you've got mother tongue target. So any localization requires going through and getting the mother tongue piece in place,
and then
you've got to redo all of the audio tracks. It's about 3 gigabytes of content.
So
it's not and that's already significantly compressed. If it's not compressed, you're looking at probably 100 gigabytes, which is a lot of content, right? So,
a lot of recordings. Yeah.
Yeah. God, yeah. Spent weeks in a recording studio, and I was like, and we built our own in China at the time when we did it, and it was like a little space with the aircon on, and then when we started recording, the aircon goes off and you go for about 10 minutes until you're dripping, and then you're done with that piece, and you come out and turn the aircon on again, and then spend 20 minutes cooling off and then back in for another round. So that was how we did that back in the day. We did the app. We did CDs and stuff first, but we did the app basically when the iPhone came out, when the App Store was just getting started. So it gives you a bit of the time frame.
Wow.
And it's not an app. The app on the device is simply the syringe. The medicine is the entire system, which is the audio, the video, the way it's structured, the way that we check people's progress, give them feedback, right? That's
yeah, and, sorry. And I used app as an encompassing term, and I should be more with system. Yeah, I just went a bit reductive.
No. It's not a problem. Not a problem. It's one of the, because you were talking about digital technologies and apps and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And our intent when we started to do this was to take the best of what is known about how languages are learned, which is also technology, and work digital technology to deliver that in a simple, convenient package that allows you to have a language in your pocket, and you've got the methodology and the content, so you can learn anywhere, anytime. So we're leveraging the the micro elements of digital technology. We're leveraging the feedback aspects of it, the tracking aspects of it, the fact that you can now put lots of video content into a small bundle and use it. So we're using all those aspects of digital technology, and we're bringing the best of language learning pedagogy into a system which makes it fun and leads to people actually learning successfully.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what we like to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it sounds great. No, honestly, like I don't have a current interest in learning learning English, Mandarin speaker. I definitely don't. For some reason, I was thinking learning Mandarin then, but yeah, no. But if you had a version for English speakers learning Japanese, because I've just started learning Japanese, I'd be fascinated to try it. Yeah. So yeah, sounds great.
If you've enjoyed watching this episode, you know, remember to like, share, and subscribe to the channel. If you're looking for more content from myself of Team Teacher Fame, you can go to www.teamteacherchina.com, where we've got a whole bunch of PowerPoint materials that you can download, use instantly in your classroom, where we've got a Team Teacher China YouTube channel where we take those materials and we kind of show you how to use them. Team Teacher English, where I take those materials and I put them into kind of like self-study videos that you can use to give to as homework or just, you know, kind of watch them yourself. And then Team Teacher Baby, where I take all my knowledge of language teaching and put it into teaching my child. Dun, dun, dun. And Rich?
YouTube.com/ProfessorRich for English teacher materials. Twitch.tv/ProfitGaming for occasional Twitch gaming streams, especially on weekends. And feel free to contact me, ELT_@gmail.com, if you think you have something worthwhile to contribute and you'd like to come on and talk to us.
Yeah, and leave some comments below.
Leave comments below for the things that you like, the things that you don't like, and we'll do more of the things that you don't like, because that's what we do.
And thank you very much for coming on the show, Chris. We're going to leave you with the last portion of this episode, so over to you.
Alright, people, if they want to know more about Kung Fu English, and they can go to kungfuenglish.com, KUNGFUENGLASH.com. It's all in Chinese, but I'm sure if you use Google browser, you can see what's being written. Anyone who's sort of looking at expanding their business in the language areas, they can reach me on chris@kungfuenglish.com. And in terms of people learning, we're all language geniuses. We've all done at least one all by ourselves, and we can do others. So, you know, let it rip. You have what it takes. You've already done it. You just need to remember that and sort of oil some of those squeaky, rusty hinges, and you'll be fine.
Marvelous.
Fantastic. All right.
Yeah. Bye-bye. And there's a book, isn't there? There's a book people can buy and have a read of, right?
Yes. Right? The Third
Ear.
Oh,
yeah. what was that?
The Third Ear. The Third Ear. It's 1, 2, 3 ears. The Third Ear. You can learn any language. You can find it on Amazon. That's basically the only place you find it, I think.
Yeah. We'll stick a link down in the description below for that.